Kennedy's, President Franklin, Delano Roosevelt, addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Welcome to the show, Fireside Chatters. What a wonderful day it is. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm your hazy host, Greg Carlwood, and today I'm flying solo for a talk with a man who's been researching the alternative side of things for over two decades, and that man is Ken Thomas. Ken prefers to call his area of research parapolitics, as opposed to the loaded term conspiracy theories, and he is the man behind the popular Steam Shovel Press publication and has authored over a dozen conspiracy and paranormal books of his own, including NASA, Nazis and JFK, JFK and UFO, and his newest Kindle book, Popular Parapolitics. He's done more conspiracy research than I've done breathing, and I'm damn proud to present him to you today. Ken, welcome to my stupid stoner show.
Well, Greg, thank you very much.
My pleasure. And, you know, I myself have been interested in conspiracy for some time, and I started out as a student of the David Icke's and Jordan Maxwell's, and I really didn't know much about the work of so many other people until I met Adam Gorightly, and he introduced me to a whole new set of great researchers, yourself included. So lately, I feel like I'm a kid in a conspiracy-filled candy store, you know?
Adam Gorightly, he's one of my gurus. Actually, I have this whole scheme to wrestle Jesse Ventura in the ring that I will secretly put a mask on Gorightly and put him in the ring in my place.
That's awesome.
He's into that Mexican wrestling stuff, but he's a fabulous writer. One of the cool things is that he contributed a chapter to a book of mine called Secret and Suppressed, too, in, about Tuesday Weld.
Yes.
A television actress who may have also been some kind of high priestess in a druidic cult.
Yeah, we actually had Douglas Hawes in the show not long ago.
Exactly.
What do you think of the Jeff Turner stories, since we're on the topic?
Well, it dovetails into my recent lecturing because... one of the things I'm doing is demonstrating how the Kennedy assassination was telegraphed in advance, a year in advance, on national television in a program called Route 66.
Yes.
And there's an episode of Route 66 that has Tuesday Weld as the star. She's like 18 years old. And it has all of these weird things in it because this is, again, this is came out in 1962, a year before the assassination. Mm-hmm. And the two guys, Route 66, the premises... basically Kerouac and Cassidy driving across the country. And the premise of this one is they drive into a fictional town that is right outside of Dallas. They drive past the highway sign. It says Dallas, Waco, and the name of the town is Kilkenny.
Oh, man.
And Tuesday Weld's character, I forget her name, but it's a double M. It's like a Marilyn Monroe thing, an anagram.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have photographs of George Maharis's brother. George Maharis played one of the two guys. He played the Neil Cassidy figure. But his brother, we got pictures of his brother partying at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club during the making of this show. So there's all these Kennedy connections, and you could call them synchronicities, but what they basically are predictions or forecasts of what's going to happen. But at the same time, there's this subplot about how Tuesday Weld was abandoned as a young child. And her sister, like, ties her to a tree, and there's this tree that looks like, you know, the whole thing looks like a druidic cult. Uh-huh. So it ties all into what, you know, Jeff Hawes was saying, and Adam had in that little essay.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting topic. I mean, it all hinges on the thoughts and ideas of one man, which makes it kind of, you know. But, I mean, yeah, there's definitely seems to be other links throughout the world that show that this could be the case. As far as your research is concerned, I mean, a little piece of Ken Thomas history that I really liked was that your publication, Steam Shovel Press, it started with an interview with Ram Dass. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly true. Richard Alpert, who was Timothy Leary's partner at Harvard before they both got fired for giving undergraduate students LSD. And you know, Tim Leary went on to great fame on his own, kind of developing the science of neurologic. But Richard Alpert kind of dropped out. He went to the East. He got a guru in India, and he changed his name to Baba Ram Dass. And he's a fascinating man, very interesting guy. And I was working for the newspapers here in town, and I had this one assignment. He was coming to town, so I had this assignment, go do an interview with him. And I did, and I swear I almost became enlightened talking to this man. But we had a fabulous interview. It was great. But then when I did it, and I, you know, typed up the transcript and was, you know, ready to turn it in and get paid for it, and they decided to nix it because at that point, Ram Dass had already gone. You know, he came, he did his lecture, and I did my interview, and he was gone. And so the newspaper figured there's nothing there to promote. So therefore, we won't use it. And I'm like, oh my God, I've got this fabulous interview with this brilliant man, and you know, it's going to go to waste. And it wasn't just about the money, because I, you know, I billed them a kill fee. So I created the small magazine. This was like in 1988.
Wow.
Before a lot of your listeners were born, I'll bet.
Yeah, I was 3 years old.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, so I needed to put it somewhere. So I created this small magazine, nothing much more than, like I said, I didn't pay for it. Anything I got above and beyond that, it was simply just a matter of taking some good work and making sure that somebody else got to see it besides me and Ram Dass. So at that point, that became kind of a catch-all for everything that I wasn't getting paid for, but that I had an intense interest in. That, you know, I couldn't, for instance, shortly thereafter, I became fascinated by Wilhelm Reich, a naturalist scientist in the 1950s who
did
orgone energy. And so I was writing stuff about that. And, you know, there was no reason here to get it published. Although, interestingly enough, just today, I was writing a tribute thing for Jim Moseley, who used to publish Saucer Smear. And he died recently, and Tim Beckley's putting together this collection of people's thoughts. And going through the research on this, I discovered at one point here in town, one of the local radio sports anchors was killed by her husband after the guy read Listen, Little Man by Wilhelm Reich.
So
it was this weird murder connected to Reich. But this was, of course, before Steam Shovel Press number 2, which was a compilation basically of my research on Wilhelm Reich up until then. And then the third issue, I spoke to Amiri Baraka, who was like the only black member of the Beat Generation. His name is Leroy Jones. He changed it to Amiri Baraka. And I did an interview with him, and that interview actually got published, but there was more to it than got published. So then I put that. And at that point, what was going on in the subculture of conspiracy research was that Mae Brussel died. Mae Brussel was like the maven, the queen of conspiracy theorists, the guru of us all. She died, and the major journal that was being published at that time called Critique, the publisher there found a guru of his own, a self-help guy named Robert Lemasters. So Critique was changed to Living Fire. And it all became the homilies of this new age guru. So that was gone. Mae Brussel was gone. Critique was gone. And it just, you know, it just seemed to me that the whole thing was falling apart. The whole idea that there is a subculture of critically thinking people that can see through the crap that the mainstream media tries to put out there and try to dig at the little conspiracies that are actually going on. It seems to me that was disappearing. And that was just too big of a tragedy to let happen. So
of course,
at that point, I put in a call for papers, in the last page of Steam Shovel Press number 3, and I said, I described the situation, conspiracies. We need to write about conspiracies. I want to hear from you. I want to continue to produce this magazine. Only we're gonna, instead of just, you know, being things that fall out of my regular work, I'm also going to do a directed thing to make sure some kind of conspiracy publication, gadfly publication, still remained out there.
Very cool. I mean, it seems like you've been going strong ever since. And, you know, for people who aren't that familiar with your work, it seems that your current focus has been this link between the lesser known Maury Island UFO case and the assassination of JFK. It's a subject of your one of your more recent books, JFK and UFO. And I had never heard of the Maury Island case until I started looking into you, and it's a great one. So if you'd be so kind, give the people a little lesson on the Maury Island Incident 101.
Yeah, isn't that weird? I mean, you're certainly not alone in not knowing much about Maury Island. There's only been one book on the subject. It was an early edition of my book, But the book that I have out now is the only one that goes into detail. And the basic, the big headline underneath it all that you would think would attract many more people is that the guy that was responsible for the initial UFO cover-up, when the UFOs, they started seeing UFOs in the late 40s, the guy who was responsible for the cover-up is most likely the grassy knoll shooter in the Kennedy assassination. I mean,
that's nuts.
Yeah, that is quite nuts, and the historic trail is as solid on that as almost anything that you're going to read in a history book. Maury Island happened in 1947, a few days before Kenneth Arnold started he was flying over Mount Rainier, and he saw these chevron-shaped craft.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of the modern UFO period, supposedly. That's when, after that is when the wave, when people started seeing them all over. But 3 days before that, there was this instance out in a harbor near there in Tacoma, Washington, in Puget Sound, where these guys in a boat, it was a salvage boat, in lumbering, they chop down trees and they transport them through waterways. And every mm-hmm. once in a while, a tree will break loose. You know, they're like branded and stuff. But a tree will break loose. So these guys, I mean, they weren't government people. It was a privately run harbor boat that would go and salvage these logs and check out the brand and take it back to the logging company and collect a reward. That's how they made their living. So they're doing this one day, and these saucer-shaped things show up above Puget Sound. There's like a half a dozen of them. They're all circling one that is wobbling. One's having trouble up there, and it starts spewing out some junk onto the boat. And the boat is owned by a guy named Harold Dahl. His son is on the boat with him, and their dog is on the boat with him, and a couple of other people. The son gets struck by some of the slag, and his arm gets hurt. The dog actually gets killed by some of it, and they have this whole incident. And then, you know, one of the saucers taps the wobbling one, it straightens up, and they all fly away. They have to take the boy to the hospital, you know, they throw the dog into the harbor, and they're coming away totally freaked out.
Now, I always hear this stuff described as slag, but what is that?
Well, there are two substances, a white and a black one. And a rock-like material. It was really superheated when it struck the boat and struck these people.
Okay, but some kind of like molten metal, like molten.
But it hardens enough that they were able to collect samples. Because what Harold Dahl did at that point was he went to tell his partner in this Harbor Patrol boat business of his. And even though the boat is registered in his name, we've got the registration in the book, the boss of the operation was his partner, this guy named Fred Crisman. And he goes to tell Crisman. And Crisman comes down and says he sees a saucer himself, a different sighting. But that one flies away. But together they collect this slag. So what has ever happened, you know, well, however, it was formless and, you know, it's described as hitting the water and releasing steam. So it was hot.
Ah, okay. Okay. I just wondered how, because it seemed like a liquid, and I wondered how they kept it in, a Kellogg's box. And also, why would you keep something that killed your dog? But I guess if it, you know, that makes sense if it was a heat thing and then it hardens and becomes, you know, something you can carry in a box.
Well, you have to remember, this is before the UFO wave. This is going to be the weirdest thing that ever happened to these guys.
That's also another good point as to why, you know, to the legitimacy of it. You know, he doesn't have a lot of references for craft in the sky that he could just try to be getting popular off of.
Right, right, exactly. They're just collecting this stuff because, you know, supposedly it's just a weird thing that happened to them, and here's some proof of what it was. And they didn't, you know, they certainly didn't realize at the time that Kenneth Arnold himself was hired to investigate their story. And that's where they took the Kellogg's cornflake box. That's where Fred Crisman took the Kellogg's cornflakes box. And Dahl brought samples, and they showed them to Arnold. They told him the story. They showed him the area. And Arnold didn't know what to make of it either. So he called the Air Force, the newly formed Air Force, actually. The Air Force hadn't existed until like almost right up to this moment. But these two investigators, Davidson and Brown, came from, you know, representatives of the Air Force came out, talked to Arnold. Arnold had Chrisman bring out his Kellogg's Corn Flakes box of the slack, and he gave it to Davidson and Brown. Davidson and Brown, they don't know what to make of it either. They put it on a B-25, and they're going to fly it back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to test it to see exactly what the heck it is. Their plane crashes through some obvious act of sabotage. Mm-hmm. Both of those guys are killed, and everything is dropped after that. So Fred Chrisman loads up this weird stuff onto the plane that crashes and kills these guys. And at that point, from that point forward, there is no real investigation of the Maury Island case. There still is no real investigation of the Maury Island case. Up on, I think it's the Lo-Fi website, I have this whole thing about, this is in Kelso, Washington, that an effort needs to be made to excavate this place because the plane crash is still there. And we can still investigate it.
Wow. But that would be fun.
Yeah. But it didn't happen then. So Chrisman clearly involved in the earliest of the UFO cover-up operations. And then, boom, you know, 1963 comes around. Chrisman kind of disappears at that point. And then he doesn't reappear until 1963, where he is a grassy knoll shooter. Now, I say he is, and that's just that... It's my opinion that he is, although it is mine, and other people would have other opinions. But it is also the opinion of Jim Garrison. And Jim Garrison is the only guy who took a prosecution to court over the Kennedy assassination. He was the subject of the Oliver Stone movie. Most people, you know, who are into the assassination from the early 90s forward know it through Oliver Stone's movie.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's about Jim Garrison's case, and Jim Garrison himself felt that Fred Chrisman, same guy involved in Maury Island, was the grassy knoll shooter.
And what evidence is there to put him on the grassy knoll on that day?
There's photographic evidence, for one thing.
That'll do it.
Yeah, there's a famous thing in the JFK assassination lore are the tramps, the three tramps. There were three tramps that were arrested in the rail yard behind the grassy knoll and kind of paraded out, and the photographs are interesting too. I mean, these are two guys that they suspect might be involved in the assassination, but you see them being walked through the street, and you know, the cops' guns are facing down, and it's all kind of a very casual thing. And the identity of these three tramps have been investigated and labeled as different people at different times, but Garrison's point of view was that one of the tramps was Chrisman. Now, I show these photographs in my lecture and point it out side by side. I could show you the one that looks like Chrisman. Surely does look like him. Garrison took this photograph, actually, and this gets into Popular Parapolitics, which is my book on pop culture conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
But Jim Garrison went, you know, it was a highly controversial investigation into an assassination that had been publicly closed. You know, the Warren Commission said it was a lone nut. And here's Garrison, you know, got really famous and notorious for challenging that. And so he gets on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and explains a few of the things. And at one point, he takes out the tramps photograph, and he's just about ready to say, this man here is Fred Chrisman. But Johnny Carson shuts him down before he can say it. You know,
really?
Yeah. There's no, you know, most of the, a lot of the Carson shows were destroyed, including that one, but an audio copy of it exists, so you can hear it happening. You know, I've got that, and sometimes play that at the lecture. But yeah, Johnny Carson's it was the man who prevented Fred Chrisman's name from being nationally known as the shooter. It's interesting is that whole situation was not in the original theatrical release of Oliver Stone's JFK movie. But if you get the home versions now, there is a scene that had been cut out. And John LaRocque plays the Johnny Carson figure. And they reenact that whole thing.
Whoa, that's pretty awesome.
Although Chrisman, again, is not really mentioned in Oliver Stone's movie either. Because you remember, Garrison's case was not against Chrisman. It was against a guy named Clay Shaw. Garrison, you know, he figured Chrisman was a trigger man. And he was trying to get at the actual conspirators, the power elements that were behind the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, and the only person that he could make a case against was this socialite named Clay Shaw, who did have some involvement with it, but obviously, you know, it wasn't enough to convince a jury, or Garrison wasn't able to make the case. But the final point to be made about that is that in, you know, and that happened in 1968. In 1977, the House of Representatives conducted another investigation into the assassination, and it concluded that there was a conspiracy. And that became the official, and is still the official conclusion of the U.S. government, that there was a conspiracy to, that the assassination involved a conspiracy. And the original Warren Commission conclusions that there were three shots from the book depository was wrong, because in those hearings they came up with a tape that demonstrated it was a fourth shot, and it was all still up in the air, and they turned those conclusions, and nobody knows that either, because at that point when that happened it was like buried in the backs of the newspapers across the country.
Right. And that's, you bring up an interesting point, something I wanted to talk about, and it's in Popular Parapolitics, one of the first things you talk about. There were several reporters that said there were three shots. Now, science has determined there were more. People investigating have determined there were more. But it seems like the people who said the presented narrative as it was meant to be on that day, probably knowing it wasn't true, or maybe not, but the people who were willing to say there were only three shots fired, they all seemed to have pretty prominent careers after that, after telling that lie.
That's exactly right.
That's a really interesting point.
Well, you know, the media is still the same today. They basically just take the press releases that come out of D.C. or from whatever authority and kind of reread it. You know, there is no real investigative reporting going on anywhere on anything, you know. Mm-hmm. So same then.
One of the big things that people look at when they see the Zapruder film is that his head tilts the wrong way. I mean, that's the evidence to where the shot came from. And you also tell a story of a reporter who was talking on the radio and purposely was deceptive about the direction of Kennedy's head to make it fit a little cleaner with the official story. And that man, of course, everybody would know today. It'd be Dan Rather.
That's Dan Rather. Right. I have the audio of that, too. I've got that in a tape loop where he's describing Kennedy falling forward. Kennedy doesn't fall forward. He gets hit from the front and falls backward.
And you would think that if you were running a news network and someone couldn't tell the fucking direction of a person's head, that you wouldn't want that person presenting information anymore. They're not a credible source. You'd think you'd get someone else.
Right. And at the time, of course, Rather had no idea that the film itself was going to be presented on television. It didn't get put on television until years later when Dick Gregory and Robert Groden brought it to who's that guy? Yeah, Geraldo Rivera's show.
Ah.
Yeah, and that was the first time it was ever shown. So Rather's thinking that nobody's ever really going to get to see this. It's just
right.
A radio report.
So you can just lie about it.
Right.
Funny thing. But let's talk a little bit more about Fred Chrisman. You know, he's had this supposed first UFO sighting, you know, in that time. And then he's supposedly the grassy knoll shooter. Who is he? Like, what is his role? Who is he employed by? Are there any other interesting things about him?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, the book goes into great detail. Chrisman is actually on the scene even before Maury Island, weirdly enough. He was part of there were these pulp magazines published by Ray Palmer called Fate and Amazing Stories. You know what pulp magazines, you know,
zines.
They're kind of like comic books before pictures.
Gotcha.
A lot of them had science fiction stories and all this other stuff. One of the things that this publisher, Ray Palmer, put in his, though, were stories about something called the Shaver Mystery. And this was a kind of a legend created by a welder in Pennsylvania, a guy named Richard Shaver, who said he was picking up signals from his welding equipment and learning all these things about this underground civilization called the Deros, D-E-R-O-S, for the detrimental robots. And people and Palmer published this stuff, and people, his audience around the world started writing stories saying, yeah, I've seen those creatures. And the creatures really seem like the little gray aliens, too, that people talk about. And so he would publish this in the letters column. And Fred Chrisman was one of the letter writers. And he talked about encountering the Deros in Burma and getting some kind of laser beam shot into his arm, even though this was before the laser was invented.
You know, if you can describe a technology before it's even out there, I mean, that gives some credibility.
Right. Well, Chrisman was on the scene even before that. There was the first article ever on a science fiction convention appeared in a magazine called Harper's Weekly. and Fred Crisman's interview. He's one of the people there. He's a science fiction guy, and he's just telling about how neat it is to be at a science fiction convention.
Weird.
So, yeah. So
it's like, was he a conspiracy investigator or paranormal investigator turned CIA operative?
Well, he was a veteran. He was in like a lot of people, a lot of the guys in World War II. He fought in World War II and in Korea. He was reactivated. So he was an army guy and a science fiction fan. And also he was a worker at the Hanford nuclear reactor up there in the Pacific Northwest, which gives us another interesting little piece of his history, because the guy who approved his job application when he got that job is a guy named Mark Felt. Mark Felt is now known to history as the informant deep throat to Woodward and Bernstein of Watergate fame. So you've got that connected up. I mean, and then the curious thing about that also is that Mark Felt was a writer for television shows too, a consultant and a writer, like a lot of intelligence people are. And he wrote or consulted to a program called the FBI, which was a Quinn Martin production. His name of the production company. Quinn Martin also produced a program called The Invaders with Roy Thinnes. And Crisman made the claim in 68 that this story of The Invaders, which was architect David Thinnes, sees actually a very well done Adamski craft. I don't know if you know George Adamski, if you know your UFO lore, but he sees this craft one night. It's a flying saucer, and he sees the aliens, and he knows the aliens are there. And the premise of the show is that he's out to fight the alien conspiracy. And Crisman's saying, this is the story. This is my story. This show is about me. And, you know, people, Crisman gotta be nuts, crazy. But here he is directly connected to Mark Felt, because it's Felt who got him the job at the Hanford nuclear reactor. And it's Felt as a consultant to the Quinn Martin Productions, which makes The Invaders. So
that makes sense to me. it definitely makes you think.
Yeah. So it's not just a historic trail. It's a whole architecture that holds up the premise.
And one thing I wanted to address about the Maury Island case is I've talked to a few friends, you know, just bullshitting. I'm like talking about what's going to come up on the show, and I mentioned it, and I was met several times with the response, I thought that was dismissed as a hoax. So I feel like we should address that, because you know, a lot of people think it was a hoax. You don't, and I think you have a pretty good reason why.
What would that be?
Well, you know, when I was looking into this, just that. The man's light. Well, go into the Men in Black visitation.
Okay, well, that's what I was hesitating, because I'd already given you so much lore.
I love lore.
But here we go. Yeah, this the idea that it was a hoax. The reason people think it was a hoax, or one of the reasons, outside of the fact that everything connected to UFOs is a hoax. You know, people who like to think of themselves as critically intelligent people aren't going to, you know, take anything seriously. It's all a hoax.
Of course.
Other than that, Harold Dahl, the guy, the victim of the Maury Island case, said it was a hoax. He originally came forward and he was telling everybody what had happened. And then all of a sudden one day, yeah, the Men in Black show up. And this is the beginning of the Men in Black phenomenon. And they go to him and they say, you will stop talking about this or bad things will happen to you. And he was like, well, you know, that's a bunch of crap. And he kept going, telling people, as many people as he could, about what had happened to him. And his wife fell ill after that. The son, who had the injured arm, disappeared and was gone for months and months, and they found him. He was like abducted or something, and they found him in Wyoming somewhere, without memories of what had happened to him and that kind of thing. And all of this weird stuff started coming down on Harold Dahl. So at that point, he said, okay, I'm a believer. It was a hoax. If anybody asks me, it's a hoax.
Right. If you can look at those things in his actual life and, you know, determine the downward spiral, I see validity to that.
Yeah, sure. There's a lot to it. You know, another interesting thing about Harold Dahl is that the three tramps in the rail yard have official arrest records. There are official people that they say it was. And one of them is a guy named Harold Doyle, which if you say with a Texas accent, Harold Dahl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
But that's just a coincidence.
Right. Well, you know, you have a line in Parapolitics that I think is great, and you say there are two schools of thought. You're either a conspiracy theorist or a coincidence theorist, and I think that's great. I find that all the time, and a big part of why I butt heads with some more conventional people is this issue of how much weight you put on coincidence. That's really all we're talking about, and even that can be a slippery slope, though, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of, you know, I've been lecturing about Maury Island and JFK for a couple of years now, and part of the way I'm pushing the story forward and making my lectures a little bit different than they have been is examining this whole idea of coincidence and synchronicity and what role it plays. I bring with me now these episodes of Route 66. I mentioned one, but there are actually two. Well, actually, there are three.
Right. What else is interesting about that?
Well, another episode of Route 66 opens up in Fort Worth, at the Fort Worth Airport, where Kennedy flew in that day. One of the guys, again, it's George Maharis, the Neil Cassidy figure, gets a job at the Trade Mart, which is where Kennedy was going to before he got shot. He was supposed to give a talk at the Trade Mart in Dallas. And then at some point, one of the characters gets on the phone and starts talking to Earl Cabal, who is the mayor of Dallas. And it's his brother, Charles, who was a CIA operative who was fired by JFK for his role in the Bay of Pigs. And it's Earl Cabal who changes the motorcade route from where it was supposed to be going to the road in front of the book depository in the grassy knoll. And so all of this is written into the script of this Route 66 episode, which was broadcast in 1962, a year before the assassination.
It'll make your jaw drop. I mean, you know, we talked about Route 66, the invasion. I mean, that's one area that I'm really interested in is that crossover between Hollywood and conspiracy or Hollywood and real events. What would your explanation for that be? Like, have you come to any conclusions regarding why that takes place?
Well, it could be any number of things. You know, there are people that really get into these kind of mystical connections of coincidences and synchronicity. My old friend Robert Anton Wilson, who wrote the book Illuminatus, made great use of that in his books. Another writer, James Shelby Downard, is well known for connecting up all these coincidental elements that connects the assassination to Masonry and all that stuff. So there's that going on. But there's also this idea that, and John Judge tried to make this clear to me. John Judge runs the committee a committee on political assassinations, the big JFK, RFK, MLK activist group run out of Washington, D.C., the people that are going to be putting on the big protests there this year in Dallas. And John Judge was a student and a close friend of Mae Brussels, and he's like one of the stalwart guys of conspiracy research. And his view of it is that these intelligence agencies and the intelligence agents are – we got them throughout the entertainment industry – and they try out things. You know, they come up with an idea that maybe they could pull off, and they'll put it in a script to see how it works out. And so you can see time and again that things that happen are like kind of predicted in the media. I ran into this when I did, I'm kind of known for this book called The Octopus, which is based on the Danny Casolaro case, which involved this software called the Promise software. That was Shanghai and used in something called the Inslaw scandal. That idea was put into an episode of The Lone Gunman, which was this, you remember The Lone Gunman was like an X-Files offshoot show.
Gotcha.
Yeah, there were three guys who published a zine, and their first thing they investigated was the software that was being put into a plane that was being set up to crash into the World Trade Towers. And this was months before the Trade Tower thing happened.
That was months before.
Yeah, just months before. It was the same year. I think it was March of 2001.
It is crazy. I mean, even in more recent times, you see it in the Batman movie, in the Dark Knight movie, with the Aurora shooting.
Right. That's what's happening with Sandy Hook, you know, the killings in Sandy Hook. You go to this Batman movie, and there's a scene in the Batman movie. There's a map next to a cell phone, and the map says Sandy Hook.
Yes.
You know, there's a developing line of research that all of this had to do with a banking scandal called LIBOR, LIBOR.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the hearings for that were called off after Sandy Hook, and that the parents of the killer in Aurora and of some of the kids in Sandy Hook, the both of them were somehow connected to this LIBOR scandal. And that what's really going on is a big cover-up of that.
Right. That's kind of what I was going to ask you, is if what you thought the motivations were for that. Because there's people who say it's a false flag to usher in stricter gun control. There's people who say it's an Illuminati ritual killing. And then, right, there's that LIBOR scandal situation where both John Holmes and Adam Lanza's fathers were apparently set to testify. And that's just what I read on the internet. Like, what do you make of all that? Because I don't see if it was if they're set to testify in the LIBOR scandal, I guess it could be like a punishment for them. Like, hey, we're going to make your kid, we're going to mind control your kid into being a patsy for this brutal massacre. And that's all fine and good. But what about the people that, well, wouldn't you just kill that kid? Wouldn't you just kill his kid and say, you know, now testify?
Well, the idea was to create these situations that become more important than any kind of investigation of some obscure banking scandal in England.
Good point. A sexier story.
Right. So, I mean, so all that stuff just gets dropped because everybody else is paying attention to it. That's why I think that the one thing that it's not about is a Second Amendment argument. Or you know, gun control.
Right, right.
Because there's just too much attention being paid to that. That's got to be the false dialogue that people want us to pay attention to cover up something else. So it would seem to me to be more likely that it's something like this.
That's a great point. You mentioned Wilhelm Reich earlier, and something I wanted to get to is another story in that Popular Parapolitics, great book. It was very odd. Was the Cloudbuster Cannon? Can you tell us about the Cloudbuster Cannon?
Oh, where to begin? Well, Wilhelm Reich was a protege of Sigmund Freud during the early days of development of psychoanalysis. And he came up with his own theories about character structure that are still very important texts. And people, you know, go into psychology or psychiatry, they're always still required to read Character Analysis by Wilhelm Reich. But when he was first exiled to Norway, where he started doing experiments that tried to establish the underlying energy force in life. Those were the Bion experiments. He left Norway, came to America, and at that point his research developed, and he started calling this energy orgone, and he started creating a technology on how to develop it and how to use it. There were orgone boxes, and the idea was that people could sit in the orgone box and charge up their life energy and come out of it much healthier and more vibrant kind of thing. And then as that technology developed, he created the Cloudbuster gun, the Cloudbuster cannon, which was supposed to operate on the environment the way it operated on people. The purpose of the Cloudbuster was to slowly, gradually increase moisture in desert regions to fructify the earth and make it less of a wasteland. But what happened, and I just covered Wilhelm Reich's whole life there.
That was good.
So I urge everybody to not listen to me, but just take me as a cue to go read Reich. For one thing, whether what Reich was wrong or nuts or whatever, read him. He's brilliant. One way or another, just read him if you want to understand psychology. But what happened there at the end was that he created these – when he created these weapons, he brought them out to the desert. And one interesting fact is that in his last book, Contact with Space, he talks about going through Roswell, New Mexico. And this is 1955. It's actually an argument I have with a lot of ufologists and a lot of skeptics who believe that the Roswell was a product, you know, that something happened in 47, but the people forgot about it. And then in 1980, Stan Friedman and all these guys saw an opportunity to exploit it and bring it back. Well, this is not true, because Roswell had a long impact that's measurable in history long before 1980, long before, you know, a resurgence of interest at that point. In 1955, Wilhelm Reich takes his Cloudbuster guns through Roswell, New Mexico, talks about the alien environment, the dry environment, starts coming up with this idea that this is what the aliens are doing, that they're sucking the living energy out of the earth for their own sake. And it's not a big part of Contact with Space, but it's clear, and it's clear from other passages that he heard the radio reports about Roswell, and it's clear that he's going out to see what kind of impact whatever this alien connection is having on the Earth. And so in the process of doing that, he starts, well, actually even before that in Maine, he started seeing
UFOs himself, flying saucers himself, and he started pointing the cloud buster guns at them, and they start to blink out. So so he got the idea that, you know, that maybe, you know, I mean, theoretically to him, that maybe redirecting Oregon stream toward these UFO would be one way to battle them.
Yeah, that's what I read, and I was like, that is so interesting, because I mean, it must mean that he was seeing them fairly frequently.
Yeah, and across the country. I'll tell you what, another pop culture parapolitical dimension to this is a movie called Earth versus Flying Saucers. You ever see that one?
I have seen that. It is pretty low budget, if I remember.
Yeah. Well, it has special effects by Ray Harryhausen, who's like famous for being one of the greats.
It's all black and white, right?
It's black and white. It's a movie in the 50s. They load up these cloudbuster guns on the backs of Jeeps and fight flying saucers in that movie. And they finally capture one of the aliens, and the aliens are walking around with these big helmets on. They remove his helmet, and it's a Roswell Gray, you know. So there's more proof that, you know, Roswell was not off of people's minds. It was, you know, I mean, that was a movie that was getting wide distribution, and you have Roswell in there, and you have Reich's cloudbuster guns are quite clearly right there.
I can't imagine that story would have been forgotten 10 years later. I mean, look at 9/11. People are still debating that. You know, it doesn't seem like it was even 10 years ago, but a story like that, the first UFO crash, the first alien bodies recovered, I mean, a story like that, that's not going to get to page 5 in 10 years.
Yeah, right. And you know, it's almost every time you turn around. I mean, I found references. I found Roswell Grays in a Japanese cartoon called Prince Planet from 1965.
Weird.
You know, things like that, you know.
Well, you know, we're talking about aliens. You've been involved in this for a long time. You've been writing for a long time, longer than I've been breathing. And
okay,
have
you feel old now?
Well, you know, it's a good thing in this case. But have you ever tried to map out a timeline of alien human contact? Like, what does that look like to you? Do you think that they're just visitors who, you know, even our own governments don't know what's going on, or are they in contact? I mean, I've heard the Eisenhower story, probably the most fascinating story.
Right. Yeah.
Do you think any, like, what's your timeline for alien human contact? If you had to bet.
When it started?
Well, I mean, of course, you got the ancient aliens idea. You've got the reptilian idea. I mean, that's okay. A possibility. It could have started forever ago. But
okay. All right. Let me answer it this way. It is not a non-mainstream theory that aliens have visited this planet and have been manipulating it and changing it. This is a theory that was put forward by Francis Crick of Watson, Crick and Watson, the guys who discovered DNA. Crick's idea was directed panspermia, that life itself on this planet was brought here by aliens, you know, and I don't know if they're reptiles or bug-eyed aliens or whatever, but it's not a non-common sense view. It is a mainstream point of view. This is actually something that I'm beginning to realize more and more, that, you know, because I work underground mostly in a counterculture, I assume that most of what I believe is kind of unique to be believed, but it's not. You know, like I said, the Kennedy assassination, most people, 99% of the people, understand that that was a conspiracy, and the government itself believes that aliens manipulating human genetics and interacting with Earth people, that's Francis Crick, that's mainstream science. You know?
Yeah, what an interesting conclusion for him of all people to come to. Strange.
The guy who understands life better than many others. So right. It's you know, so I offer that out to everybody who probably like yourself, certainly like me, who gets derided as a conspiracy nut and you know, a flying saucer wacko. But it's not wacko, you know. We're normal people, and this is normal mainstream science, and also normal mainstream, not politics, but parapolitics, you know.
Right. And I have heard you talk about that Eisenhower story, and it's very interesting. It's the only story I know of a president communicating or meeting with some type of extraterrestrial race.
There's also a Reich connection there. There's a a diary entry that actually, if you look at Eisenhower's schedule, he goes to Rangeley, Maine, shortly after that alien incident, and it's pretty clear that he had some kind of meeting with Wilhelm Reich. And there's other documentation. There's something called the Cutler Twining memo that's in the National Archives. I've held this document in my hand, and it says that they're rescheduling a special studies subcommittee of MJ-12. And MJ-12, the MJ-12 papers, that's another big part of the UFO lore.
Right.
But there was another researcher of the biography of a British diplomat named Lew Douglas who came up with another document that talks about Reich getting a meeting with people in the government on that precise day of the Cutler Twining memo. So it's not just two pieces of documentation. It's like triangulation of research, you know? So there's a clear indication that the government had an interest, and they had an interest in Reich, and, as nutty as it all seems, it was something that was truly going on.
Yeah, it seems to me like at that time, from probably 47 on, it seemed kind of like the government was scrambling. At one point, they're trying to suppress all this information. At the same time, they're trying to gather their own information from people like Reich or, you know, whoever doesn't think that this is completely ludicrous.
They're trying to put a lid on it. You know, they're trying to own all the information and stay on top of it.
What more do you know about the Eisenhower story? It's really interesting to me, but it also seems really hard to believe, because if there's an alien race, you know, coming to this planet, how do they get in contact with the president without having a mass sighting, without a mass disclosure? Like, how do you get in there that deep? Do you know the answer to that?
What's the best way to answer that? I can tell you one thing. The full story, as I understand it, with as much documentation as I can bring to it, appears in Secret and Suppressed 2, Eisenhower and the Aliens. And it's like anything else. I mean, secrecy is been practiced, particularly the national security state, you know, been practiced and done well for many years and developed. So it doesn't seem to me so unusual that, you know.
Well, it's unusual in this way. Like, think about us. Think about if Mars was a civilization, you know, that couldn't reach us, and we wanted to go and make contact with them. How would we infiltrate their system in a way that we meet covertly with the one specific man who actually is in charge of things, without just hopping down on the planet and being like, hey, you know, here we are. Let's talk to some people. Does that make sense? Like, how would you infiltrate their network when you don't speak the language, you don't know how the government operates, you might not even know what a government is? It seems odd that they could streamline that communication and keep it quiet.
Well, you might not, but then again, you might. You know, I mean, if the aliens are intelligent, and the idea, well, one of the big theories about Roswell is that they became attracted to the Earth after the atomic explosions out in the desert. So, so they're monitoring what's happening. The idea that they're monitoring communication, that they can figure out the bureaucracy. Actually, human bureaucracies are really kind of easy to figure out who's the boss. And, well, it's, you know, and then if you're sending down people that, you know, men in black sorts, you know, to interact and make connections that way, it makes a certain amount of sense. You know, that kind of description of the alien activity does seem to be something out of the 50s, though, you know. The post close encounter view is that it's all going to have to be pretty obvious.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an odd thing.
If you want, we can do a whole program on that one. It's just.
Well, that's the thing. I wanted to, but I was wondering if there's enough meat on those bones.
Oh, there's plenty. There's plenty, and it all really has to do again with going back to the biography of Wilhelm Reich. Reich was, people said he was crazy and he died in prison because, you know, up until the time he died, he felt that Eisenhower was on his side.
Yeah, that's going to kind of sad.
You know, and I'll tell you, interestingly enough, just in terms of word rhyming, a guy who's into Reich is Ike, David Ike. I think his book called The Biggest Secret reprints the first few pages of Contact with Space, which is Wilhelm Reich's famous last book.
Very cool.
Yeah. And you know, Ike actually is also somebody who's really kind of cued into coincidences. That's how he kind of started his career. He used to be a BBC sports writer.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Yeah. And then some weird set of coincidences and synchronicities happened to him, and he got onto this path that he's on to now. So it's part of the, you know, when I bring up the Kennedy coincidences and the coincidences between that and the Moy Island case, I mentioned also that David Icke has some interest in that. Also, Bob Dylan, in the last interview that he gave for Rolling Stone, he starts talking about, there's a famous incident in rock history where Dylan got into a motorcycle crash, and he was off the scene, like in 1966, and he was off the scene for many years. But there was a second Robert Zimmerman who died in a motorcycle crash at the same time. And Dylan goes off about this in the Rolling Stone. He starts talking about how it transfigured him. There was something about the amalgam of the coincidences of those situations that kind of freaked him out. And yeah. Kenneth Arnold himself was a student also of coincidences. He used to carry around in his wallet the Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences. You know those, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln, and Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy, and blah, blah, blah. Well,
Kennedy was killed in a Lincoln.
Right, and Lincoln was
killed in Ford's Theater.
In Ford's Theater. And then Lincoln gets, anyways, yes, there's a whole list of them. And Arnold carried that around. He also, his own book, which came out in 1952, called The Coming of the Saucers, which is about the Moore Island case, he never autographed a copy of that for his daughter, Kim Arnold, until November 22nd, 1973. Just to put it into the pattern. And so Kim Arnold actually sometimes makes the lecture stump at the UFO conferences, and she talks about all of that. But the one coincidence that she doesn't bring up is the coincidence of Fred Crisman being such an important part of her father's story, but also him being the grassy knoll shooter. Because I'll bet, and I've sent emails to try to find this out, but I'll bet Kim Arnold doesn't know that. Just like most Americans don't really know that Crisman has been fingered as a grassy knoll shooter, and that's practically the government's point of view.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of people, we're getting down kind of to the end of it, but a lot of people have this idea in their head, or I think it's kind of like a surface level conspiracy that, you know, Lincoln was killed in public and Kennedy was killed in public, and it was done for the reasons that they were both trying to mess with the currencies in the country and trying to, you know, loosen the stranglehold from international bankers. And it makes sense. It definitely does. When you look at the money, you always follow the money. And so you got to think that that plays a role. But that's not really the conclusion for the reason of the assassination that you come to, is it?
Well, no, I don't. Actually, I think what happened with Kennedy, anybody like Kennedy who was progressive and wanted the best democratic processes to prevail in his country was at odds with the moneyed establishment. But my view is, people hold up there are certain dollar bills that do not say Federal Reserve on them, and people hold that up as proof that Kennedy was trying to get us away from the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that those are promissory notes meant to retire the debt of coins. Coins contain silver, and the silver at one point, because of the price of the silver in the market, was worth more than the coin. So they issued these promissory notes just basically to retire that obligation and to take silver out of the coinage. So that
almost seems contradictory. That almost seems like a move towards more fiat currency, which would enslave the country more.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think, if Kennedy was, well, certainly Kennedy was opposed to secrecy and oppressive government. I mean, he had the example of the communists that he always worked against. Whatever was going on between him and the Federal Reserve, I'm sure is worthy of study. But I'm just saying that in that particular case, I don't think those dollar bills prove that.
Yeah, you don't see that as the necessary linkage.
No.
What you do point out is the contracts with Boeing. Is that the reason you think he was assassinated? Because we didn't talk about the actual reasoning.
Oh, well, Boeing, yeah. You know, Crisman also worked for Boeing at one time.
Another interesting link.
Yeah, another interesting link. Yeah, but... Kennedy, remember, was reversing what was going on in Vietnam, because it was, you know, clearly that was the wrong path for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that LBJ did when he assumed office was to reverse that process, to reverse
ramp Kennedy's, it up.
Yeah, to stop Kennedy's de-escalation. But in the process of de-escalating, of course, Bell Helicopter, Boeing, all of the arms manufacturers were taking big hits.
It's the same story. It's follow the money, just a different angle. Instead of it being so huge as to be a slap against the Federal Reserve, you know, you can think of it as, I mean, Boeing's got a shady past, and I don't see why they would have any problem hiring an assassin to kill the president if they weren't getting their contracts. I mean, I could see Halliburton doing something similar if Obama, for whatever reason, was to be like, all right, everybody come home right now.
Right.
I think he'd probably be dead too. But of course, when Obama got elected, I said to friends, you know, I was like, hey, this guy's talking bold. I felt like Hillary was supposed to be the establishment candidate, and maybe he won out because of the internet. And I said, the only way to know for sure if he's legit is if he gets assassinated. It's a shame, and it's a very sad and cynical view, but I mean, here we are.
Well, I said something actually kind of similar to that in a blog from my publisher, Feral House, which publishes JFK and UFO. But before the election, I said it, an assassination is going to somehow factor into this election. And it was shortly after that came out when the Libyan ambassador was assassinated. And that hung like the sword of Damocles over Obama's campaign until the word went down and Romney didn't use it to any great effect. But that could have had a large impact, that assassination, you know?
Yeah. Man, and this, before we get going, I mean, this seems like a pretty basic question, but you've been a professional archiver for many years and a thorough and leading researcher into conspiracies. How would you educate someone in the art of taking a curiosity they may have about an event and being able to actually do the research into things that are thought to be unattainable?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Okay. Well, there is, in one of my books, it's How to Be a Researcher, there's a chapter and the book is called Parapolitics, not to be confused with the current Kindle book, Popular Parapolitics. But I have a whole article about how to do research through the Freedom of Information Act. It's like anything else. It takes patience and time and some intelligence. You know, if you know of an incident, get the names, investigate the lives, start making the connections. If there are documents to be had, you got to locate the repositories that have them.
That's a good. How do you do that?
Well, you got so many more tools now online to do it, you know, than I ever did when I had to do it all.
That is true. There's also more bullshit out there.
Right. Yeah. The signal to noise ratio is worse than it used to be. Use your archives, you know, primary sources are the best, but primary sources are the things that they cover up, you know, with the most passion, you know, the smoking gun.
Right.
The document that proves one thing or another is likely to have been destroyed. So a lot of times all you have is implications and inferences. And the approach that I've taken, and it comes out of my association actually with Timothy Leary, whose philosophy was one of pure intelligence, of gathering data and letting the data speak to you, to not look at it from radical posture that you're a leftist and you're going to expose, or you're a right winger and you're going to expose the government that way. Just look at the data, and then what is the data telling you? So in order to do that, you have to collect the data. So you just collect it, and you collect it from every source, and it doesn't really matter how outrageous it is, because at some point you're going to have to do a triangulation of the data, and whatever's speaking the loudest to you is what's likely to be as true as anything you can research.
Well, there you go.
That's a tough road to hoe. I mean, it's very hard for people to do. Like you said, I've been doing archives work for 25 years. You know, it's my job, 40 hours a week, to do stuff like that, usually on much more banal topics.
But that does put you in a pretty unique position. And I would say to anybody who's standing there on a treadmill listening to this, you know, put out some Freedom of Information Act requests. I feel like my hands are tied a lot. I love doing the show. I love talking to the researchers. But I'm just like, man, I kind of like to get out there and do something, dig something up. I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's exhilarating. It's exhilarating, particularly, you know, if you have questions. You know, I was 5 years old when Kennedy was assassinated. And the country was screwed up ever since that point.
A little interesting anecdote about that is I was having dinner with my parents the other day and telling them about upcoming shows. I mentioned you and the Kennedy assassination. My dad was 13. I asked him, I'm like, hey, do you remember where you were when that happened? And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, well, first, everybody does. But secondly, he said, I had a paper route. And on that day, I was going around delivering papers. And every person who I gave a paper to would come out and be like, did you hear what happened? And I'd be like, no, what? No, what? And they'd be like, Kennedy's been shot. You're like, oh, my God. I can just see my dad going door to door, acting like he had no idea. Getting the news from so many different people.
Well, then, like I said, compare and contrast. To 1977, when they finally concluded it was a conspiracy. And it didn't make a single front page headline.
Of course.
Right back in the back of the papers, and, at that point, I mean, yawn. But that's, and that's not even the end of the story, but it's closer to the truth of the story than it ever was when your father was a kid.
Right.
But it was still, my God, the president was shot. This is, the world's falling apart, And clearly they came up with a Warren Commission thing just to try to shut people up and have an official conclusion that you can fall back on, but that nobody was, that didn't sit easy with anybody.
One other thing, one little fun thing I wanted to throw in before I let you go. I hope I'm not keeping you too long. One event that happened this past week, I haven't been able to talk to anybody about it or get anyone's thoughts on it, and you seem like as good a guest as any, and that event is the meteor crash in Russia. And I saw a video that you had posted on, I think, the Steam Shovel Press Facebook page that showed what looked like a UFO busting up that meteor in the air. What did you think of that video?
That's kind of why I put it out there. What did you think of it?
I thought it was interesting. If you consider the line of thought that ETs are here to help us and sort of guide us and keep us from blowing ourselves up, because there's a lot in ties in with the nuclear facilities and UFOs hovering over them. It seems like it fits the bill that a UFO would smash up a meteor to make smaller pieces so it doesn't completely destroy a big chunk of the Earth.
Well, that other asteroid that was coming close at the same time got closer to the Earth than most of our communication satellites.
Yeah, what's the deal with that? I thought they could see these things coming from a year away.
And now they're all happening at once, too, right?
Right. If this would have been just 2 months ago, would have been a whole different mess. December 21st, 2012, been a whole different mess.
But yeah, right. But the point is, though, that there is a level of secrecy that is attendant to everything having to do with advanced technology and space travel and, the moon hoax theory and all that other stuff. It's there, and reading NASA press releases doesn't get you closer to understanding what actually happened.
I agree with that. Well, Ken, I mean, that about wraps up our time together. I have had a great time.
Let me say one more thing.
Sure.
On the theme of popular parapolitics.
And of course.
This is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and so far, only two movies have been announced that are going to be coming out in the fall about JFK. One of them is with Tom Hanks. It's called Parkland. And that's going to be Forrest Gump meets the Kennedy assassination, right?
Right.
And it's about what happens at the Parkland Hospital. The other one, and I don't know this much about it, but I know it's going to be the movie to watch. It's called Dallas in Wonderland. And one of the co-writers on it is Adam Parfrey, who is my publisher, who runs Feral House. And James Shelby Downer is supposed to be going to be in it, and it's going to be all about the various theories and things. And it sounds like how they're going to do it is a mystery to me. It sounds like it's going to be a fascinating movie. So if you're looking, if November comes around and you're not at Dallas, where you should be, if you're a Kennedy assassination person at all, we should all converge on Dallas in the 50th anniversary.
What event is going on? Because let's tell people, because I think people should, start getting involved in some way.
Yeah.
People are converging on Dallas. I mean, there's a lot of, is that going down? You mentioned earlier protesting in Dallas.
Right. Well, the Coalition on Political Assassinations in Washington, D.C. You can find them in a web search. The guy who runs that is John Judge. Find him on a web search. They have been talking to authorities in Dallas because the authorities in Dallas have been discussing some kinds of ways to put a clamp down on what's happening there this year of all years. They have a ceremony there every year and a protest there every year, but this year they're kind of worried about it. So Judge has been talking to Dallas authorities about what's really going to happen. He's been negotiating for you know, people not getting their heads beat in or whatever. So that's what I would recommend to people. Look up Committee on Political Assassinations with John Judge, and you go to their front page, and it will spell out exactly where people are going to meet in Dallas. And
that'll be in November, right?
Yeah, November 22nd.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I also want you to take a minute to let the people know where they can catch up on your latest works and keep up with you and Steam Shovel Press on the web.
Well, Steam Shovel Press Facebook is probably the best thing. I just really kind of just got up on Facebook, and I'm having a lot of fun posting things there in ways I couldn't do before. But there's also steamshovelpress.com, the website, which I now occasionally update. And one of the things on that website actually is a video of a lecture I did once in the Mojave that has to deal with the comic book artist Jack Kirby, who, among other things, had a strong role in what happens in this movie Argo, although Kirby's name isn't mentioned. And anytime you see anything by Marvel Comics, they hardly ever mention his name at all. You know, he created every one of those trademark properties that are making billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Kirby's one of the finest comic book artists to ever take a pencil to a page, and his heirs do not see a penny of that. So that's a conspiracy I like to put out in front of people. So you can order that through the website.
And that is something I learned from you in Popular Parapolitics, and then I went and researched it a little bit. But I guess Jack Kirby was working for Stan Lee. Stan Lee was his editor and just was like, oh, these are great, let me take these. And now we have Stan Lee as the famous creator of all Marvel superheroes. That's fucked up.
Stan Lee is nothing. He did nothing. Nothing. Statistically irrelevant, whatever it was he did. Jack Kirby created all that stuff.
Man.
And it's a crime. You know, and it's another corporate crime, you know.
There are many.
Right. So anyway, I have a lecture about that you can get through steamshovelpress.com. So the Kindle book is called Popular Parapolitics. If you don't have a Kindle, that you can download software that gives you the ability to read the book on your computer. So you know, the book is cheap too, because it's not really a book, it's just a Kindle. The book out there, the actual book that you can purchase at a bookstore, is called JFK and UFO. And it's all about what we've been talking about, many more connections. I never do it justice. I always feel, even after the best of interviews, I always, you know, God, I didn't say this. There's just a ton of information in that book. And so I recommend that to your readers. And I think that pretty much covers the basis.
Excellent.
There's a Gmail account at this website if you want to contact me directly.
Very cool. And I mean, I'm so happy Adam Gorightly put us in touch. It's been a real pleasure. You're a wealth of knowledge and information. I respect the painstaking, monotonous job of being a true researcher. And, you know, you, along with plenty others, deserve all the respect in the world. So thank you, sir, and keep fighting the good fight.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
All righty. Have a good one.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening, people. That was Ken Thomas. I'm Greg Carlwood, and this has been another episode of the Higher Side Chats. If there's a guest you'd like to see on the show, just Facebook me, or you can email me at thehighersidechats@gmail.com. Please share and review the show. It is the new currency of the digital era, and I really appreciate that. If you by chance have any real currency left, please check out my t-shirts at conspiratees.net. And a new THC should be available every Sunday, so please keep us on file. And remember, we're all God's children. Enjoy your fucking day. To the club like, what up, I got a big pack, I'm just pumped, I bought some shit from a thrift shop, ice on the fringe is so damn frosty, the people like, damn, that's a cold ass honky, rolling in hella deep, headed to the mezzanine, dressed in all pink, set my gator shoes, those are green drapes, and a leopard mink, girl standing next to me, probably should have washed this, smells like R. Kelly sheets, piss. But shit, it was 99 cents. I get copping it, washing it. About to go and get some compliments. Passing up on those moccasins. Someone else has been walking in. Bummy and grungy fucking mint. I am stunting and flossing and saving my money. And I'm hella happy that's a bargain, bitch. I'ma take your grandpa style. I'ma take your grandpa style. No, for real. Ask your grandpa, can I have his hand me down? Thank you. Velour jumpsuit and some house slippers. Dookie brown leather jacket that I found. Dig it. They had a broken keyboard. I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket. Then I bought a kneeboard.
hello, hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game, hello. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads will be like, ah, he got the Velcro.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is fucking awesome.
Ow.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. Awesome.
What she know about rocking the wolf on your noggin? What she knowin' about wearing a fur fox skin? Whoa. I'm digging, I'm searching right through that luggage. One man's trash, that's another man's come up. Whoa. Thank your granddad for donating that plaid button up shirt, cause right now I'm up in her stunt. I'm at the Goodwill, you can find me in the I'm not stuck on searching in the section. Your grandma, your auntie, your mama, your mammy, I'll take those flannel zebra jammies secondhand and rock that motherfucker. The built-in onesie with the socks on that motherfucker. I hit the party and they stop in that motherfucker. They be like, oh, that Gucci, that's hella tight. I'm like, yo, that's $50 for a t-shirt. Limited edition, let's do some simple edition. $50 for a t-shirt, that's just some ignorant bitch. I call that getting swindled and pimped. I call that getting tricked by business. That shirt's hella dope. And having the same one as six other people in this club is a hella don't eat gang. Come take a look through my telescope, trying to get girls from a brand. Man, you hella won't. Man, you hella won't.
Goodwill. Popping tags. Yeah.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is fucking awesome. I'll wear your granddad's clothes. I look incredible. I'm in this big ass coat from that thrift shop down the road. I'll wear your granddad's clothes.
Damn right.
I look incredible.
Now come on, man.
I'm in this big ass coat
from
that thrift shop down the
Let's
road.
Go,
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is fucking awesome.
Is that your grandma's coat?